Welcome to today's reading of the San Angelo Standard Times, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Michael reading the San Angelo Standard Times newspaper for the week of Sunday, October 10th, 2021. I'm reading on Thursday, October 14th. I'll begin with the most recent articles first. COVID-19 update, a look at San Angelo coronavirus data for October 2021. Tom Green County, as of October 14th, City of San Angelo. 24,702 positive cases reported. 20 new positive cases. Deaths, 445. 290 from Tom Green County and 155 from other counties. 37 currently hospitalized. 451 active cases. Tom Green County COVID-19 Vaccine Tracker by Diane Pantaleo, USA Today Network. Tom Green County has administered more than 105,598 doses of the COVID-19 vaccine as of October 5th, according to data from the Texas Department of State Health Services. That's up 3.28% from the previous week's tally of 102,248 COVID-19 doses administered. In Tom Green County, 42% of people living in Tom Green County are fully vaccinated as of October 5th. Update: Two Stripes employees injured by bullet fragments during accidental shooting. By Elena Edgen and John Tufts, published October 14th. This story has been updated after more information was released by the San Angelo Police Department. One person has been detained after two people were injured during an accidental shooting at a convenience store early Thursday afternoon. On Thursday, October 14th, police scanner traffic reported a shooting at a Stripes convenience store on 19th Street and Armstrong Street. Two people were shot after a gun fell out of a bag, according to scanner traffic. Acting Lieutenant Daniel Williams with the San Angelo Police Department said the shooting was accidental. A spokesperson with the police department released more information about the shooting later that afternoon. At 12:45 p.m. Thursday, seven first responder vehicles, including police and ambulances, arrived at a Stripes convenience store to find two female employees who were injured from a single fragmented bullet. The injuries were non-life-threatening, a news release stated. Investigators learned another Stripes employee had an accidental discharge of a 9mm handgun. Police said the bullet struck the floor of the business and fragmented. Pieces of the bullet struck one female victim on the back portion of both her legs. The other female victim was struck by the fragmented bullet on her left arm and her legs as well. Ambulances transported both female victims to Shannon downtown, where they were treated for their injuries and later released from the hospital, a news release stated. Police said they learned Stripes employee Cameron Ransom, 22, accidentally discharged a firearm while inside the store, according to a news release. At 1:17 p.m., a reporter saw police escorting what looked to be a person in a blue polo shirt adorned with a Stripes logo in handcuffs. Officers could be seen placing Ransom in the back seat of a patrol vehicle, which left the convenience store parking lot at about 2 p.m. Ransom was taken into custody for city warrants, as well as discharging a firearm within city limits, a news release stated. Detectives with the Criminal Investigations Division advised that additional charges for Ransom may be forthcoming. Three arrested in Tom Green County after special agents go undercover as prostitutes. By Elena Edgen, published October 14th. Three men have been arrested after an online undercover operation in Tom Green County, according to arrest affidavits released Tuesday. On October 7th, special agents with the Department of Public Safety conducted a solicitation of prostitution operation in Tom Green County. agents created an undercover profile on an unnamed social media platform, according to court documents. Three men contacted the undercover agents and agreed to pay a fee for the purpose of engaging in sexual conduct. The men acted on this intent by traveling to a prearranged location at a prearranged time for sexual conduct, according to the affidavits. When they arrived, they were detained by agents on October 8th on suspicion of solicitation of prostitution. The men are Chaudhary A. Kartakumar, 35, of San Angelo, David Salas Rios, 56, Marneco Montez Pratt, 36, of Europa, Mississippi. They have since been released from Tom Green County Detention Center on a $7,500 bond, according to online jail records. The documents did not state if they all met at the same location or time. Woman holding baby reportedly threatened with gun during argument in San Angelo, by Elena Edgen, published October 13th. A San Angelo man has been arrested after an argument led to a loaded gun being pointed at a woman holding a five-month-old child, according to an arrest affidavit released Tuesday. On September 30th, police responded to an unknown problem on Guadalupe Street. An officer discovered a man and a woman had an argument inside the residence. The woman had been taking the crying child to a bedroom, which upset the man and led to the argument, records state. The man attempted to take the child from the woman, and she refused. He then took a black Smith & Wesson gun from his pocket, racking it round into the chamber, and pointed it at the woman and the child, according to an affidavit. He told investigators the argument was due to the woman taking the child from the bedroom, and he did have a loaded gun but did not point it at them, records state. Hart Angel Becerra, 22, was arrested October 1st on suspicion of endangering a child by criminal negligence. He was released from Tom Green County Detention Center on a $15,000 bond October 3rd, according to online jail records. Flash flood advisory issued for San Angelo area Wednesday. Turn around, don't drown, by John Tufts, published October 13th. The National Weather Service in San Angelo issued an urban and small stream flood advisory for parts of the Concho Valley on Wednesday afternoon. At about 1:26 p.m. Wednesday, October 13th, a flash flood advisory was issued for the following areas until 4:30 p.m. Southern Coke County, Northern Irion County, Southeastern Sterling County, Northern Tom Green County. Doppler radar indicated heavy rain due to thunderstorms with 1 to 2 inches of rain having fallen already in northwest Tom Green County around Water Valley, according to the National Weather Service. Heavy rainfall will move into San Angelo around 2:30 p.m. and cause flooding of low water crossing and streets, according to the National Weather Service. Here's everything you should know about San Angelo Revolution Film Festival, times included, by Elena Edgen, published October 12th. Over 60 films will be playing this weekend in San Angelo's Revolution Film Festival, from comedy to horror, even documentaries. The three-day event promises something for every movie lover to enjoy. From Thursday to Saturday, October 14th through the 16th, people can check out films across genres. Film types are separated into blocks per day, with movies ranging from 3 minutes to over an hour, according to the schedule. Tickets can be purchased at the San Angelo Performing Arts Center, 82 Gillis Street, or online at sanangelopac.org. Prices are $27.50 for all 3 days, $11 for 1 day, and $5.50 for a 1 day ticket for military, students, and seniors. Different film blocks will be at the Elta Joyce Murphy Performance Hall, 72 West College Avenue, and the Brooks and Bates Theater at the San Angelo Performing Arts Center, 82 Gillis Street. People can reach the festival at 325-655-4136. Email info@sanangelorevolution@gmail.com or Facebook. Fatal crash near Sonora between two semi-trailers kills Houston man. By Elena Edgen, published October 11th. A Houston man died after two semi-trailers crashed early Monday near Sonora, according to a news release from the Texas Department of Public Safety. About 5:20 a.m. Monday, October 11th, Texas Strait troopers investigated a crash involving two trucks hauling semi-trailers on Interstate 10, 8 miles west of Sonora. A semi-trailer traveling east on Interstate 10 struck a guardrail, then entered the westbound lane, where it struck another semi-trailer driven by a Houston man, according to the release. Junio Maximo Esquilona, 32, was pronounced dead by Justice of the Peace Joseph Harris. He was not wearing a seatbelt, record state. The driver of the first semi-trailer that struck the guardrail had no injuries. The release listed the driving conditions as clear weather and dry roads. Update: another arrest made in Monday's homicide, the sixth in Abilene this year. From staff reports, published October 12th. The victim of an afternoon shooting in West Abilene died late Monday afternoon, and the suspect is facing multiple charges after fleeing and causing a vehicle crash. Edward Daniels, 43, died at 5:29 p.m. at Hendrick Medical Center, according to Abilene Police. Police responded to a call at 2:38 p.m. concerning a discharged weapon and injured person in the 4,000 block of Redbud Circle, just north of the Elmwood West Shopping Center. Multiple police units and an Abilene Fire Department truck responded to the scene. The victim, with at least one gunshot wound, was taken by ambulance to Hendrick about 3 p.m. The suspect, later identified as Malik Therese Corbin, 22, was at large. Police believe the suspect knew the victim. At about 4 p.m., Abilene police began a vehicle pursuit of Corbin. At one point, the suspect was driving southbound in the northbound lanes of South Danville Drive. Police say he intentionally struck a sedan at Danville Drive and Post Oak Road. Corbin was taken into custody without resistance at 4:09 p.m. at that intersection. He has been charged with first-degree felony murder, second-degree felony assault for the vehicle collision, third-degree felony unlawful possession of a firearm by a felon, third-degree felony evading arrest with a motor vehicle, and state jail felony possession of a controlled substance, methamphetamine, police said. Corbin has been booked into Taylor County Jail, but online records did not release bond amounts. In connection with the investigation, police also arrested Cassandra Green, 35, according to a Tuesday news release, for a charge of third-degree felony hindering apprehension. She is in Taylor County Jail, and her bond was set at $137,000. Green allegedly witnessed the incident and provided false information to investigators concerning the whereabouts of Corbin, police said. Sixth Abilene homicide in 2021. Daniels' death is the sixth homicide in Abilene this year, compared to three in 2020 and six in 2019. The first homicide was February 17th, when police, responding to a domestic disturbance at an apartment complex in the 3000 block of North 6th Street, found a 35-year-old woman who had suffered trauma resulting in her death, according to a previous report. Two juveniles were in the apartment at the time and were placed in protective custody. Joseph Rogers died at a hospital after sustaining a knife wound May 5th at a residence in the 1800 block of University Boulevard, according to Abilene Police. Fernando Gallegas of Abilene was indicted August 5th on one count of murder stemming from the incident. He remains in the Taylor County Jail on bonds totaling more than $1 million. The death of Priscilla Limon, 38, whose body was found May 5th at Fort Phantom Hill Reservoir, later was ruled the city's third homicide. Blake Andrew Brittner, Roger Scott Wilson, Ashley Renee Alanez, and George Edward Froch, all of Abilene, were indicted August 12th on one count each of aggravated kidnapping in connection with Limon's disappearance and death. They remain in jail, and the bond for the charge is $150,000. Judy Jones, 68, was found dead June 14th in her West Abilene apartment. Court documents indicate she had been stabbed in her living room. Grandson Joel Thomas of Abilene later was arrested and indicted on one count of murder in connection with her death. He remains in jail with a bond set at $251,000 for the murder charge. He also is being held on warrants for unrelated charges of burglary and trespass. The body of Carlos Velez Jr., 33, was found at about 3:30 a.m. August 31st in a convenience store parking lot in the 900 block of East South 11th Street. He had suffered apparent trauma, police said, and the incident is being investigated as a homicide. Webster and North Jefferson Street closed for 2 weeks. What San Angelo drivers should know. Contributed by the City of San Angelo. Published October 10th. Beginning Monday, October 11th, the intersection of Webster Avenue and North Jefferson Street in San Angelo will be closed to replace sewer mains and manholes. Vehicle detours will be marked in the areas where construction is occurring. The closure is expected to last approximately 2 weeks, pending any potential weather delays. This work is part of the North Monroe Rehabilitation Project, which will replace existing sewer mains and repair roads in Forest Park Avenue and North Monroe Street. Other road construction updates. In the September report of active street projects, the city reported 90% of street repairs from Winter Storm Uri had been completed. Bell Street's roadway reconstruction is 90% complete and ahead of schedule to be completed by December. The downtown Chadbourne Street project is 99% complete on street construction, complete on sidewalk construction, and 25% complete on traffic signals. The Tuig and Chadbourne intersection remains closed. Southwest Boulevard project is tackling low water crossings. If weather does not cause delays, the Southwest crossing near McDonald's will be completed in approximately 10 to 12 weeks. The low water crossing near Tractor Supply to Loop 306 is ongoing and could cause traffic closures. The North Chadbourne Street from Loop 306 to 43rd Street has finished the water main replacement. The sewer main replacement is 15% complete and the street reconstruction is in the bidding stage. The September report mentioned the completed projects include MLK Boulevard's reconstruction and relocation of utilities, Southland Boulevard's widening from Sherwood Way to the Walmart traffic light, College Hills Boulevard's repavement from Loop 306 to Valley View Drive, West Concho Avenue's widening and reconstruction of asphalt roadway with concrete. New utilities have also been installed. Southwest Boulevard's mill and overlay portion. Future street projects, according to the report, include Edmund Glenna 29th Street, which will have mill and overlay, roadway reconstruction, and utility rehabilitation. This is in the design phase. Rio Concho Drive will have a full depth reclamation of the roadway. College Hills Loop 306 to Avenue N will have road reconstruction, drainage work, underground utilities, signalized intersection upgrades, and ADA-compliant sidewalks and ramps. This is in the design phase and is 90% complete. Chadbourne Street, Avenue L to Avenue B, which will be roadway reconstruction, and the design phase is in progress. Jackson Street, Knickerbocker Road to the railroad tracks will be roadway reconstruction, is 79% done with the design phase. Howard Street, which is estimated to be completely designed in spring 2022, will have mill and overlay. An engineering firm will take core samples to verify the material under the roadway and check the current condition. Sunset Drive project from Loop 306 near Academy to Foster Road will have mill and overlay. The estimated cost is $4.75 million for the street portion and $7 million for the utilities. Craft Brewfest draws crowds AIDS Donkey Rescue in Downtown San Angelo, by Colin Murphy, published October 10th. Hundreds of people gathered in downtown San Angelo on Saturday for the 5th annual Craft Brew Fest, with part of the proceeds from the event going to support the Peaceful Valley Donkey Rescue Organization. Visitors to the event were greeted at the gate by a trio of donkeys, along with staff from the rescue group. The event featured a variety of attractions, including bounce houses for young people and samples of craft beers and live music for the adult crowd. Chris Ling, one of the organizers of the festival, said he was happy with the turnout. "It's about what we expected, so we're pretty pleased with it so far," Ling said. "We're going to do this every year, so make plans to join us next year. If you can't make it out to this one, it's going to be bigger and better every year. It's been a little hard to get volunteers to help out. We're making it work." Stigmas surrounding mental health get smashed in San Angelo, by Colin Murphy, published October 9th. A van covered in messages like "Get over it" and "Figure it out" or "Don't be such a downer" was smashed to pieces on Saturday by a group of people attending the second annual Smash the Stigma rally hosted by the San Angelo Clubhouse. The event, held prior to World Mental Health Day on Sunday, was designed to give people an outlet for their frustrations and draw attention to the stigmas faced by those who suffer from mental health issues and those who seek help and support during their struggles. Participants were invited to write messages on the van that reflected insensitive attitudes they had encountered, and then to literally smash the words with a hammer. The director of the San Angelo Clubhouse and affiliate leader for the National Alliance on Mental Illness Texas of San Angelo, Amy Mizell Flint, said the event not only provides an outlet for people, but also raises awareness of the stigmas attached by society to mental health. "These are things that some people around the world think apply to people who struggle with mental health," Mizell Flint said. "Of course, we know these things are not true, and we are really excited about the symbolism of smashing the stigma on the van. We wanted to let people write those stigmas on the van and then smash them with a hammer. We want to help people remove the stigma from their minds," she said. One of the attendees at Saturday's event said it felt like a weight was lifted to symbolically smash the stigmas and to also raise awareness during a time when mental health issues have come to the forefront during the COVID-19 pandemic. Tim DeMichi said the pandemic has contributed to mental health issues for many people, but has also made more people aware of the problem. "Having dealt with mental illness for 30 years plus, it was a relief in some ways," DeMichi said. "I wanted to express that the words on this van really mean nothing. The pandemic has really awakened a lot of people to mental health awareness because it's not just genetic. It's influenced by your environment. So it's time for us to accept that it is part of our world and acknowledge it." World Mental Health Day is Sunday, October 10th, and more information about local resources can be found at www.sanangeloclubhouse.org and https://nami-texas.org/nami-texas-of-san-angelo. We Walk the Walk. Abilene Running Business expands to San Angelo, specializes in comfort, by Elena Edgen, published October 9th. An Abilene business with a love for running has made tracks into San Angelo, offering the best shoe for you, according to the owner. Angelo Running Company, 3542 Sherwood Way, opened in June 2021 and is filled with gear made for runners, walkers, and people who are on their feet all day. Joe Cook, owner, promoted the store's free gait analysis, which has the customer show their running or walking form. Employees examine footage and use this information to find the best shoes for the customer. "We want to fit you in the shoe that's best suited for you to help you get better," Cook said. "It makes a difference. We do have shoes that are good for everybody. Runners, walkers, people who are on their feet all day. This is the second running shoe for owner Joe Cook, who opened his Abilene Running Company, 2654 Industrial Boulevard, 7 years ago. It was a meager start, and then it just kind of took off, Cook said. We were getting people from San Angelo and thought we should save them the drive. When asked why Cook got into running, he said he started back in 2005 and got hooked. A lot of people see it as punishment, like having to run laps when in trouble in school, Cook said. There's a different side of running that is enjoyable. It becomes therapeutic. On the store's website, Cook assures customers that the stores only carry products from companies that were created by runners, for runners, and that I would use when I run. We walk the walk, we talk the talk, Cook said. People can keep up with the business through their Facebook, Instagram, or at therunnerstore.com, which works for both locations. The store also organizes social runs. A historically black church in San Angelo reaches milestone of 125 years by Dudra Butler, special to the San Angelo Standard-Times, published October 8th. It was May 1883 that Bishop Richard H. Kane appointed Buffalo soldier Reverend J.W. Walker to a new field, or unoccupied territory, to organize the first Negro church in San Angelo. Walker was stationed at Fort Concho in San Angelo as part of the 10th Cavalry. San Angelo was a town of a few settlers, mesquites, cow trails, and a few colored families, mostly soldier families. The town was so unsettled that the ministers of the day preached with their guns by their sides. Walker is credited with founding the first church in the black community, which was penned Greater St. Paul African Methodist Episcopal Church. Bragging rights for me. J.W. Walker was the father of my godmother, Letty B. Smith. Sadly, the first, the historic Greater St. Paul African Methodist Episcopal Church, my birth and home church, is no longer in operation. Today, it would be 138 years old. A proud moment for me and the membership past and present at the time was when our beloved church was designated an historic site by the United States Department of the Interior in 1988. The first colored public school was held in the basement of this church, as two school board members were stewards of the church. I read that the membership was very alert and civic-minded. I was born in the 1956, and I am old enough to remember when the heart of the black community, starting 1st Street up to 6th Street, with Randolph running through it, was the business district of the black community, which was composed of our own grocery stores, barbershops, service stations, lawyers, doctors, restaurants, a funeral home, church, etc. It was in the year of 1896 that some charter members of four churches branched out on their own from St. Paul African Methodist Episcopal Church. Although it was a Methodist church, the first congregation was actually interdenominational, and when an opportunity arose, they each branched out on their own. The first to separate was St. Paul Baptist Church. The second was Scott's Chapel Methodist Episcopal, which was called Wesley United Methodist and now is called Wesley Trinity Methodist Church. The third was Jameson Chapel Colored Methodist, later renamed Brown Chapel Christian Church. The fourth was Second Baptist, later called Mount Zion Baptist Church. Today is known as Antioch Baptist Church. In 1896, Reverend William Taylor and about 16 members withdrew from St. Paul A&M AME and formed the first African American Baptist Church in the home of Mr. and Mrs. Adam McDonald. Then a small church was built on Tuig and Irving Streets, which they named St. Paul Baptist Church. Taylor pastored the congregation until 1900. From 1901 to 1902, the acting pastor was Reverend Teague Mills. In 1902, Reverend McPherson became pastor. The church sold the property located at Tuig and Irving Streets and purchased three lots located at 324 West 3rd Street. They erected a small church at this location with a tall white steeple on which housed a huge heavy metal bell in the center. Each Sunday, the bell was rung to summon worshipers to the church services. After Reverend McPherson's tenure, several pastors served. Then in 1944 to 1952, Reverend Carl C. Simpson was appointed. During this period, there was a substantial increase in membership, which allowed the church to create a building fund that reached approximately $29,000. They then purchased two lots at 1011 North Randolph Street, between 10th and 11th Streets. Reverend Frank Phillips was selected as pastor in 1953. Groundbreaking was held for a new church building on August 24, 1954, and the church was moved to its current location. A new parsonage was built at 322 West 3rd Street, and a parking lot was built on 10th Street. All of this during the Phillips era, which ended in April 1976 when he died. In July 1976, Reverend Hoover C. Lemons was chosen as the pastor. During Lemons' tenure, so many additions and improvements to the church were fulfilled, even the acquisition of several lots on the corner of 11th and Randolph Streets to construct a parking lot. Lemons fulfilled his duty to St. Paul Baptist Church, leaving only to start a new church, Christian Fellowship Baptist Church. After Lemons, Reverend Henry C. Gates became the pastor in May 1990 through 1996. In August 1996 through March 1997, Reverend Edward Davis served as interim pastor. In February 1997, Reverend George DeBose was appointed pastor, serving through August 1998. In September 1998, Reverend Dr. Fred B. Adams II served as interim and was appointed pastor in November 1999, serving through 2015. It was during the Adams era that the church mission statement, establishing a ministry through God's power, principles, and word, reaching the sinner, teaching the saints, strengthening the family, and enlarging God's territory one soul at a time, instituted. In July 2016 through January 2018, Reverend Charles J. Davis carried the church leadership reins. Enter Reverend Henry C. Green in November 2019 through today. Green has the distinct honor of having grown up from childhood to adulthood in St. Paul Baptist Church. Under his leadership are three associate ministers, Apostle Mitchell Reed, Reverend Derek Campbell, and Prophets Michelle Reed. At 3 p.m. October 10th, 2021, the members of St. Paul Baptist, the second and oldest black church in San Angelo, will celebrate its quasquicentennial or 125th anniversary. What an accomplishment. The speaker of the hour will be Pastor Theodore Boone. The Lord has been good to us, and you know, I have seen many saints grace the halls of St. Paul and its sanctuary, Reverend Green told me. We as a church have taken on the responsibility to carry on the hard-earned legacy for many future generations to come. Craving Crab, new San Angelo restaurant, is ready to serve, by Elena Edgen, published October 8th. Bringing in platters of seafood for San Angelo foodies, this new restaurant is hoping to serve the sea's bounty. Craving Crab, 4509 Sherwood Way, opened Thursday, October 7th with an array of seafood. A spokesperson for the restaurant said on Facebook they serve fresh boiled seafood, Cajun style. The online menu offers shrimp, crawfish, crab, lobster, mussels, and other seafood. Shrimp and crab can be purchased by the pound, with seafood combos or family plates. For people who don't want seafood, there is also wings, chicken, and sausage. One interesting item on the menu is the seafood pot, available in small for $59.99, or big for $125.99. The big pot has 1 pound of snow crab, 1.5 pounds of shrimp with or without heads, 1.5 pounds of crawfish, 1.5 pounds each of black and green mussels, 12 half-shell oysters, bean sprouts, Chinese cabbage, 8 each of potatoes and corn. People can follow the business on Facebook or check it out online at cravingcrabtx.com. Here are the pros and cons of box wine by Gus Clemens, special to the San Angelo Standard Times, published August 3rd. Box wine, or more correctly, wine in a plastic bag that is inside a box, is no longer the redheaded stepchild of the wine world. Several wineries now deliver quality wine in a box. Boda Box, Delectau Family Vineyards, Black Box, Constellation Brands, Bandit, Almaden, and House Wine are among the leaders. The draw is you can have a glass or two whenever you wish for the next several weeks. No guilt trip that you did not finish the bottle before the wine went south, or that you did finish the bottle all by yourself that night so it couldn't go bad. Another draw is cost and environmental responsibility. The two go hand in hand. The bag and box cost less to make and to transport, reducing eventual price. The box and bag can be recycled. Unless you live in a larger city with glass recycling, an empty wine bottle goes in a landfill. Box wine, however, is not perfect. Yes, the wine stays fresh after you open the box, but not forever. It has a shelf life of about 6 weeks and will start to decline after 3 weeks. Furthermore, to achieve that shelf life, you need to keep the wine in your refrigerator, not your kitchen countertop. Refrigeration is fine for whites and rosés. They are best cool anyway. Not for most reds. You will need to let most reds warm for 30 minutes to get them to their best. But not all reds. Some clever box wine purveyors offer chillable reds, light in style, more body and flavor than blush or rosé, lighter in alcohol. Box wine also is not for aging. Wine inside of a box does not age. It does micro-oxygenate. A small amount of oxygen will make its way into the bag. Box wine should be consumed within a year of your purchase, maybe sooner, depending on how long it lingered unrefrigerated on the wine store's shelves. Last round. A Catholic priest and a Jewish rabbi were friends and enjoying a meal at a restaurant. After a few glasses of wine, the Catholic priest asked why his Jewish friend would not eat pork. "It is delicious and a major source of nutrition all over the world," the priest chided. "Surely in the 21st century, you could reconsider this." The rabbi mused for a second, shook his head yes, and replied, "I will eat some pork." "Great," the priest replied. "When?" "At your wedding reception," the rabbi replied. Email wine@cwadv.com. Newsletter, gusclemens.substack.com. Website, gusclemenswine.com. Facebook, Gus Clemens on Wine. Twitter, @GusClemens. Wahl's 1971 undefeated football team to be honored at Hawks game by Charles Bryce, published October 7th. Wahl High School's 1971 football team that went undefeated and won the Class B regional championship will be honored before the Hawks game against San Angelo TLCA in the district's 3-3A opener Friday night. Kickoff for the homecoming contest is scheduled at 7 p.m. at Hawk Stadium. Back in 1971, Class B teams couldn't advance any further than regionals. That was the smallest classification in Texas at the time in the 11-man ranks. We didn't even think about it being that long ago until we stopped and added it all up and said, you know what? It has been that long, said Daniel Tudor Wild, who was a middle linebacker and team captain. And yeah, it really does. It feels like it's been 50 years. The other Class B regional championship teams in 1971 were Newcastle, Salina, Big Sandy, Little River Academy, Chester, and Agua Dulce. The Hawks were ranked number one in the state in the Harris rating system from the preseason through the postseason, which gave them the mythical state crown. The following season, in 1972, Class B teams began playing for state championships, and Chilton defeated Windhorst for that first title. The Hawks would have loved to have had the same opportunity in 1971. We weren't happy, but that's all that we could do, and I'm glad they finally changed and allowed the smaller schools to compete at the state level, Tudor Wild said. We thought we were that good, and we were pretty sure we could have won, but you never know. The Hawks outscored 12 opponents, 474-26, including 8 shutouts. In the playoffs, they combined to outscore Lorain and Grand Falls by a combined score of 114-6. Wall's offense included All-State running back Benny Holick, quarterback Jimmy Sefkik, halfback Les Plagans, and fullback Will Wild. They also comprised Wall's 400-yard relay team. In addition to Tudor Wild, other team members included Donald Braden, Dwayne Calvert, Jim Westbrook, Don Parsons, James Braden, Dusty Widener, Stephen Cadlick, Daryl Weishen, Charles Halfman, Leslie Plagans, Larry Wild, Dennis Braden, David Calvert, Gary Holick, and Stephen Holscher. The team captains were Will Wild, Tudor Wild, and Holick. Everybody played both ways every game, Tudor Wild said. Warren Townley served as the head coach, and George DeMere coached the offensive line and the defense. The Hawks were coming off a great season in 1970. Playing mostly with a different bunch of players than the 71 squad, the Hawks won 10 games, but lost in the regional finals. I think everybody decided after that loss we were going to be good enough to win the next year, Tudor Wild said. We all felt like we could do it, and it all worked out. Half a century after that magical season, Tudor Wild says the whole team is still alive, which I thought was really amazing. The 71 team would love to see another Wall football team go through a season unscathed and finally get to hoist that elusive state title trophy. Everybody who's watching, like us, would really love that, Tudor Wild said. Oh boy, that would be great. I have 2 grandsons playing, an 8th grader and a 9th grader, and they were actually talking about state championships. I believe there are some rumors going around, and they may actually do it. I hope they do. Wall came the closest to winning a state title in 2013 under current head coach Houston Guy when the Hawks advanced to the 2A Division I championship game, but lost to Cameron Yeo. Intangible qualities set Jim Hess apart from most football coaches, by Mike Lee, special to the Standard Times, published October 9th. Plenty of tangible evidence exists that set Jim Hess apart from most football coaches. He was head coach for Angelo State's only national championship in 1978 and Stephen F. Austin's first conference title in 1985. He also posted the first winning record in 14 years at New Mexico State in 1992. But those tangible accomplishments wouldn't have occurred without the intangible qualities that distinguished Hess, who who died October 2nd in San Angelo at age 84. Jim Hess met people where they were, not where he may have wanted them to be, said Mike Milligan, a cornerback for Hess's 1978 ASU National Championship team. When Coach Hess recruited Wiley Turner, the other cornerback for the 1978 Rams, he went into Wiley's neighborhood in the projects in West Dallas without a backup plan or a safety plan. That took some courage. It was a dangerous spot at the time. Even Wiley told Coach Hess not to come by himself. But he went to meet Wiley where Wiley was, not at some neutral site where it might have been a little safer. That quality allowed Coach Hess to attract and retain friendships over the years. Hess's football assets didn't end at recruiting players like Turner and Milligan. When it came to X's and O's and game preparation, Hess's tireless film study set him apart. He was one of the smartest coaches I've ever been around, said Randy Matthews, an athletic trainer in San Angelo for 40 years, including 20 years at ASU. He was always watching film at the field house. He'd spend most of the night there, and if you got there early the next morning, he was already there watching film again. Every summer, he took the football staff to Alabama or Texas A&M to meet with their coaches and learn about what they were doing. He always wanted to learn more about football. But for all his football knowledge, many of the memories of Hess revolve around his personality and intangible qualities. He hired me as a 22-year-old college graduate, Matthews said. I was young, but he allowed me to grow and use my talents as an athletic trainer. He never once questioned my judgment about letting a player go back into a game or not. I couldn't have asked for a better situation. Hess twice helped Milligan after he graduated from ASU and completed his playing days with the Rams. He made a call to the registrar's office and got them to allow me a waiver to get into graduate school without having to take the GRE test, Milligan said. He also made a call to GTE in San Angelo and helped me get my first job there. He cared about Mike Milligan, the person, not just the football player. GTE eventually became Verizon, and Milligan retired from the company as president of global wholesale. Hess's personality was as big as his bank of football knowledge. He spoke in a deep baritone voice that you couldn't ignore. He wasn't intimidating, but he walked with a commanding presence, whether it was on the sideline during a game or in the hallways at the field house. You could tell he was the head coach by the way he carried himself. A talent for storytelling was an effective match for Hess's baritone delivery. They combined to make the weekly Ram Club booster luncheons popular with local fans. When we were winning big in the late 70s and early 80s, they'd have 200 people at Ram Club, Matthews said. Hess would tell jokes, show highlights of the game, and offer his unique perspective. People came to hear Hess because they knew he was always going to be entertaining. During a football game one season at Abilene Christian, ASU jumped to a big lead, but the Wildcats were rallying behind a relentless passing attack. Late in the game, the Wildcats were within a touchdown as their quarterback dropped back for another pass. Suddenly, the lights went out for Shotwell Stadium. Consider now that Hess was also a Church of Christ member. He turned to ASU defensive coordinator Mike Martin and quipped, "Well, I guess the good Lord isn't Church of Christ after all," Matthews said. On long bus rides to road games at Kingsville or Commerce or Nacogdoches, Hess was known to spend time sitting with players individually. He wasn't necessarily talking football strategy about tomorrow's game. He talked to his players about their classes, their girlfriends, and their lives in general. His relationships with his players was unlike anything I've been around, Matthew said. Everything was about the players. He had a great deal of respect for the players. He was a disciplinarian when he needed to be, but it was not harsh. On the sideline during games, Hess dressed professionally, but not in traditional coaching attire. He wore jeans and boots, and sometimes he wore a cowboy hat or a ball cap. For his final game at ASU in 1981, Hess donned a New York Yankees baseball cap. No one ever knew why. Hess also had a unique approach with the media. He thought there was no such thing as bad publicity, even if the story was about losing. At least his program's name appeared in front of the public. In 1992, Sports Illustrated ranked every NCAA Division I-A football program from top to bottom. Hess's New Mexico State Aggies were dubbed the worst college football team in America, and the magazine dispatched a reporter to Las Cruces for an article. Hess welcomed SI with open arms. When asked why for such a negative article, he said, "If we are the worst team, then it's true. If we're not, maybe they'll come back and write another story about us." Hess coached New Mexico State to a 6-5 record in 1992, Aggie's first winning season in 14 years. Sports Illustrated came back and wrote a retraction article. Hess's football team got two articles in a national publication within the same season. Not bad for a downtrodden program located in a remote outpost in New Mexico. During Milligan's last phone interview with Hess 6 months ago, the former cornerback lamented about his final game with the Rams in 1979, a 22-19 NAIA playoff loss in the final seconds at Texas A&I. The Javelinas matched up a faster running back against a linebacker for the winning pass play. "I was telling Coach Hess how bad I felt that we lost our last game," Milligan said. "He told me for the first time that Coach Martin had called the play for the defense, but that he called an audible. He said, 'Martin called the right defense on that touchdown. I changed it. It was my fault we lost that game. You need to know that.'" "That's Coach Hess," Milligan said, "accountable 40 years later, accountable to the end." Jim Hess coaching highlights. State championship at Rockwell High School in 1963. Rice assistant coach from 1967 to 1970. Angelo State head coach from 1974 to 1981. Won ASU's only national championship in 1978. 65-23-3 record at ASU. Stephen F. Austin head coach from 1982 to 1988. 47-30-2 at SFA, including its first conference title in 1985. New Mexico State head coach from 1990 to 1996. In 1992, NMSU had its first winning record in 14 years. Dallas Cowboys scout from 1997 to 2006. Co-discovered quarterback Tony Romo with Sean Payton in 2006. Mike Lee was a sports writer, sports editor for the Standard Times from 1981 to 1996 and currently is a freelance writer for the newspaper. He also was an Angelo State student from 1978 to 1983. Looking for a scary time? Check out these San Angelo Area Haunted Locations by Elena Edgen, published October 12th. The spooky season is here, bringing costumes, candy, and haunted attractions to the San Angelo area. Here's a look at the top haunted tours in the area. Fort Concho After Dark, 8 to 10 p.m., October 15th and October 23rd, Fort Concho, 630 South Oak Street. Cost, $8 for general public, $6 for fort members. This is a night tour where guides will dive into the haunting history of the fort and spirits that haunt it. Fort Concho Fright Night, 7 p.m. October 29th and 30th, Fort Concho, 630 South Oak Street. Cost: tickets can be purchased early for $8 at Barracks 1 Visitor Center or on the days by cash. Children younger than 6 years old get in free, but must have an adult with them at all times. Haunted Corn Maze and Wall, October 22nd and 23rd, and October 29th and 30th, from 9 to 11 p.m. Circle S Corn Maze and Pumpkin Patch, 7305 Bean Road in Wall. Cost, $20. Tickets will be time slot tickets for every half hour and sold only online. Purchase tickets at circleacres.ticketleap.com/haunted-corn-maze-2021. You must show up at the time your ticket shows. This is a fundraiser event for the San Angelo Broadway Academy. Hallowfest Haunted House starts at 6 p.m. October 30th and 31st. Ballinger Community Center, 200 Crossan Avenue in Ballinger. Cost: free. Donations are accepted and appreciated. This haunted house is hosted by the Ballinger Police Association and Nexus North Point. On October 31st, there will also be a non-scary trunk-or-treat candy corral starting at 6 p.m. for free. For more information, call 325-374-6964. Hallow Scream at the Haunted Old Park Hotel, 7:30 p.m. to 1 a.m., October 29th and 30th. The Haunted Old Park Hotel, 107 South 6th Street in Ballinger. Cost, $10. If you purchase ahead of time online at oldparkhotel.com, you can skip the line. Tickets will be sold on the day at the door as well. The Haunted Old Park Hotel has been featured on several paranormal podcasts and shows, including Fright Club on Discovery Plus with the Ghost Brothers and Jack Osborne. Nightmare at Camp Williams, 8 p.m. to midnight, October 22nd and October 29th, 7 p.m. to midnight, October 23rd and October 30th, 10950 North U.S. 87 in Carlsbad. Cost, $20. This is a haunted maze and fundraiser for Volunteer Services Council of San Angelo State Supported Living Center. The maze is for ages 8 years old and older, except for 7 to 8 p.m. on Saturdays, which is for all ages. Children 15 years old and younger must be accompanied by an adult. For information, call 325-253-7920. Scare Station at the Railway Museum, 8 p.m. to midnight, Tuesday through Sunday, through October 15th through 31st, closed Mondays. The Railway Museum, 703 South Chadron Street. Cost, $15 per person, $10 for adults, military, and seniors. Tickets can be bought online at sanangelorailway.org. This is the first year of this event, which had direction and design help from Shelby Bond, a Los Angeles producer, writer, and comedian. Now here's the column from Allison Watkins. Fall is a busy time for gardening. Here are tips you can use for weeding and planting. Published October 10th. Fall is a busy time in the landscape and garden, and there have been many questions coming into the extension office as gardeners have been out working in the yard. Many people have noticed how much honeydew there is on sidewalks, cars, and the street. Aphids feed on tree sap and leave behind the sticky honeydew. But this can be prevented with an application of systemic insecticide like imidacloprid. It's best done in the springtime and will last all season long. This late in the year, it's not necessary or very helpful to treat, and the trees will likely not be significantly damaged. There have also been a lot of homeowners asking about galls in trees, mainly oak trees. Galls are abnormal growths on trees and twigs caused by insects. Most galls and gall-forming insects are not harmful to plant health, and control is not warranted. Invasive weeds that are problematic right now include KR bloomstem and khaki weed. KR bloomstem is an invasive perennial grass that is very prolific in some landscapes, as well as pasture land. It is very difficult to control because it's a perennial and there are no selective herbicides labeled for it. Pre-emergent herbicide will help prevent new plants from coming up from seed, but won't kill existing plants. Keep the lawn dense and healthy. Mow frequently at the right height and fertilize appropriately. KR bloomstem is not very competitive and mainly pops up in bare areas or stressed turf grass. Khaki weed grows flat on the ground and produces a lot of sharp burrs that spread easily. It is also a perennial. Post-emergent herbicides that contain a combination of 2,4-D with mecoprop, cafrentazone, dicamba, or metsafulfrin, for example, Fertiflome brand weed-free zone, are effective for controlling existing plants. Keep this in mind next year and catch the plants early, as the herbicide will not be effective against large mature plants. For now, use gloved hands or a garden hoe to physically remove them. Fall is a good time of year to top dress St. Augustine lawns with sphagnum peat moss, 1 to 2 bales per 1,000 square feet, to prevent take-all root rot fungal disease. The acidity of the peat will help reduce the pH and make it less hospitable for the pathogen. October is a wonderful time to plant. It's the best season for establishing trees, shrubs, ground covers, etc. Plant spring bulbs and wildflower seeds. Spruce up the curb appeal with cool season annual color. And keep the vegetable garden productive with winter vegetables like broccoli, kale, lettuce, and beets. Herbs like parsley and cilantro prefer cool weather and do well in the fall. Dig and divide spring-blooming perennials like iris and daylilies. This will keep them healthy and blooming and provides the opportunity to share with friends and neighbors. Allison Watkins is the Texas A&M AgriLife Extension Agent for Horticulture in Tom Green County. Contact her at aewatkins@ag.tamu.edu.
Thank you for joining us for this reading of the San Angelo Standard Times. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.